The Progressive Radio News Hour with Stephen Ledman, Thursdays at 11 a.m. and weekends at 1 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. My guest today is Francis Boyle. Francis is professor of law at the University of Illinois, downstate from me. I live in Chicago. The University of Illinois has a Chicago campus, but Francis is at Urbana-Champaign, and he is an expert on human rights, international law. He has written a number of very important books. He focuses on key issues. One's very important to me. One of them is the Palestinian issue. And a book, one of his books that I've used as a reference ever since I read it and quoted from a number of times, is called Palestine, Palestinians in International Law. Another one that I've cited in the past is called Biowarfare and Terrorism. And his newest book we want to talk about, it's titled United Ireland, Human Rights and International Law. Let me just mention a quick word about Ireland. I certainly am no expert. The little bit I've touched on Ireland has been very, very brief. I think I've done more, and it's been a little while, more on the economic troubles going on now as part of the global economic crisis, and Ireland is very much in the center of that storm, but that's a separate issue. The other issue involves political considerations, human rights, and the fact that Ireland is a divided country. I hope listeners know that. You've got Northern Ireland with its capital in Belfast, and Britain separated it, I believe, around 1920. And you've got the Republic of Ireland, the rest of the country, and that gained its independence, the better part of a century ago. And Francis proposes what really should be, and it never should have been anything but this, a united Ireland, just the way we need that. We need occupied areas, unoccupied, and the people freed. Well, Britain controls Northern Ireland, and Francis believes the entire country should be united. My goodness, all the divided countries should be united. Think of Korea, as a matter of fact, and the terrible things that have gone on there. But let's talk about Francis's book in Ireland. Francis, I welcome you to the program.
Well, thank you very much for having me on, Stephen. My best to your listening audience, and Happy New Year. I think this is the first interview I've given you in the year 2012. Well, and yes, you're speaking of the so-called border. As I point out in the book, there is no border. I toured back in 1986. I had some people up there. And we toured the so-called border there between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland, and there was no border. You couldn't figure it out. You just drove around. There were no markings. There was nothing. Even the people who lived there couldn't figure out where the border was or was not. It's completely artificial. It's a figment of everyone's imagination.
It's a little bit different than occupied Palestine, another issue you understand so very well. But in the past, Francis, there certainly have been conditions in Northern Ireland a lot different than they are today. And the term the Troubles was referred to. That went on for many, many years. And I'll let you pick up from that and talk about the things that you wrote about in your book.
All right, well, I would say, and with all due respect to you, Stephen, you know, the Troubles is a euphemism to try to downplay the fact that the problem in Northern Ireland is the continued British colonial imperial occupation presence. It's that simple. There are no troubles between Irish living there per se. Rather, it's the presence. As of today, it's been reduced, the last figure I saw, to about 5,000 British soldiers still occupying this little bitty portion of Northeast Ireland. Of course, at one point it was a lot more than 5,000, but it's still there. It's under military control, occupation, domination. And that is the real source of the problem here. As I argued in my book, I think, if the British, as they've done to Hong Kong, say, okay, we're going to pick up and leave as of a date certain, the Irish living there could solve these problems among themselves. But so far, Britain, at least publicly, has not given any statement to the effect that it is going to leave. So the problem continues to fester and remains unresolved despite the Good Friday Agreement peace process, which, by the way, I support, as I make clear in the book. But at the end of the day, I don't believe it's going to solve anything.
Well, I agree with you on the issue of independence, Francis. And I do know that the term troubles was a popular word, but you indicated exactly what the situation is. Ireland is occupied. I didn't realize that 5,000 British soldiers are still there. My goodness. Who are they protecting? There's no shooting going back and forth by one side of the civilian population or another. What on earth are those British soldiers doing there?
Well, I guess it's the same reason we still have 25,000 troops in Germany or something like that, or 25,000 in Korea, or 30,000 in Japan. It's control, domination, occupation. Ireland was Britain's first colony. When the Norman invaders came over there, and invaded England under William the Conqueror. And by the way, our founding father, Thomas Paine, in his pamphlet Common Sense, written after what he called the massacres at Lexington and Concord, the massacres of American citizen soldiers by actually was trained German Hessian mercenaries, said, to paraphrase, who founded the British monarchy? It was that Norman bastard and his gang of bandits. He was quite clear, and basically William was the bastard son of the King of Normandy. He had no future there, so you know, he went over there and conquered England, and then I believe it was his son who then proceeded to conquer Ireland. So, you know, this goes all the way back that far. And Ireland was their first colony, and they still refuse to leave. So that, I think, is the real problem. They're not there protecting anyone. There's a long history of Britain running death squads there against Irish Catholics. And all the security infrastructure is so-called security, I would say it occupation infrastructure, is still there. Snitches and agents and SAS, which is basically a gang of assassins. Everything's still in place, only it's now of reduced scope. And they are the problem, not the solution. They're not there to protect anyone but their own interests.
What do the people of Northern Ireland feel about this, Francis? When you get stories, and it's been a long time since Northern Ireland has been featured in the news, but when there was internal strife, you had the so-called Protestant-Catholic division. Do Protestants and Catholics still bicker with each other? Would they rather be united? Again, you also hear that the Protestants don't want to be united with the Republic of Ireland, and you propose a different name, United Ireland. They don't want that. They want to be close to Britain, not Ireland. Do ordinary people really feel this way? I mean, what's the difference? If they're Protestant, Catholic, or anything else, don't most, I mean, I would think, I know what my feeling would be if I lived there. I'd want to live in my own sovereign country, and I wouldn't want a foreign occupier, whoever it was. Any idea what the people of Northern Ireland feel about this?
Well, of course, Stephen, one, I can't speak for the people living in Northern Ireland, and I haven't been there in a while, but working on the problem for over three decades and following it, first, yes, I can certainly understand why Protestants do not want to live in the Republic of Ireland, because it is controlled and dominated by the Catholic Church. It's that simple. It's a confessional state. In essence, there is no such thing as the First Amendment. And I can understand why Protestants don't want to be run by the Vatican and the Catholic bishops. Indeed, I wrote that even before the latest scandal on sexual abuse of children by the Irish clergy that, you know, in my opinion, has been lied about and covered up from the get-go by the Vatican. So I can certainly understand why Protestants want nothing to do with the confessional state known as the Republic of Ireland. And that is why I proposed a new state that would be non-confessional and that would have our functional equivalent of the First Amendment. Obviously, we can all have different opinions about the First Amendment, but I think, you know, if you travel around the world, we're probably done a pretty good job with that First Amendment on a comparative basis for having a society that is multi-religious. And we can argue, you know, where that line should be, this, that, and the other thing, fine. But when you compare it to most other states in the world, I think we do a pretty good job here. And so I recommended that for my design for a United Ireland. And I think first and foremost, that's what's most important. Protestants do not want to be dominated and controlled by the Catholic Church. I agree with them 100%. And that does need to be taken care of. And I would say myself, because of the sexual abuse of children scandal by the entire Catholic hierarchy there in Ireland, their power is now significantly diminished. And they have used their power to maintain a confessional state, a Catholic state in the Republic of Ireland. So I'm proposing a non-confessional, non-denominational church. And by the way, there's a Jewish community in Ireland, too, that people forget about. And it turns out that Ireland is, I think, the only country in Europe that has never persecuted the Jews. Not to say there might be some discrimination, but to the best of my knowledge, they are, you know, considered to be an integral part of Ireland. And over the years now, there, you know, there have been other religious groups that have moved to Ireland as well. So I think that First Amendment type of protection is very important. We also now have the Parliament there in Northern Ireland, where you have the Catholic parties, what they call nationalist parties, and the Protestant parties, including the DUP, Ian Paisley's party, governing together in the north of Ireland. So I think that's a good harbinger for the future. And I think as this goes on, hopefully Protestants there will reach the same conclusion you have, that they would rather be living in their own state, a non-confessional state, than under the finger of Britain, or I would say under the boot of Britain. And I'd I've tried to set up a procedure for how they could, all Irish could come together and design their own state by mutual consent and agreement, and a non-confessional, non-denominational state. So that's the the concluding chapter of the book, although near the second chapter I do get into it somewhat. That was written earlier, dealing with the obligation of Britain to decolonize Northern Ireland, which is required under the UN Decolonization Resolution. And in there, I also made some suggestions about how all this could be set up and done so that, you know, Protestants can, you know, continue the life that they had before, but actually governing and controlling a new state in cooperation with Irish Catholics and as one and Jews and others.
Well, again, I support that entirely, Francis, and I would imagine I have never been to Ireland, and I don't know the culture north or south, but I would imagine a lot of Catholics would prefer a non-confessional state as well, that they're more just...
I think
just,
that's right.
I mean,
a lot
ordinary
of Catholics,
people.
A lot of Catholics there in the Republic of Ireland, where I spent, you know, a good deal of time, don't want to live under the control and domination of the Vatican and the Irish bishops. And now with the sexual abuse of clergy scandal, you know, where thousands of children were sexually abused, it's hard to imagine a worse crime, I guess, you know, just short of murdering someone. You're scarring them for life. I think they've lost all credibility. So I think there is an opening there now for people in the Republic to say, you know, we need to get these people out of politics, prosecute them, those responsible for this, again, set up our own state where we're not going to be dominated and controlled by clergy who take orders from the Vatican. I think it's that simple.
Oh, I agree, Francis. I strongly believe in the separation of church and state, and religion is fine, but it should stick to religious issues. It should stay out of politics. You mix the two, and it usually doesn't turn out very well. And if you have a state dominated by one religion, it doesn't have to be that way, but it's very possible that people of another religion could be seriously marginalized. Again, it might work out just fine. And you can have an Islamic Republic that can treat non-Muslims fine. I think Iran has a Jewish population. I don't think it's very great, but my understanding there is that I don't know who did this or whether it was a survey or what, but apparently, I hope this is true, that when Iranian Jews, or maybe a sample of them, were asked, would you rather leave and live in Israel or stay here, they preferred to stay right where they were.
Right. That's my understanding. I haven't been to Iran, but the studies I have read are that Iranian Jews consider themselves to be Iranian, and they have no desire to go to Israel. Right. I mean, between you and me, who really does want to go to Israel these days?
Well, that's exactly my feeling. I think there are more right. people leaving, Francis, than coming. And
that's what the statistics show. But
sure.
Again, I don't want to make... You know, I deal with that issue, and, you know, that's a separate type of issue that I, you know, I don't really want to mix up all that much with Northern Ireland. I think out of respect and deference for, you know, the different peoples involved, you know, we have to be very careful drawing parallels. Actually, in the past year, 2 years now, I've written one book on... Palestine and one on United Ireland, and just sort of kept them separate because they're so complicated. But I think the important issue to understand, at least with respect to both disputes, is that it's not fundamentally religious, it's political. And both problems go back to British colonial occupation of Ireland and of Palestine, and Britain carving up Ireland as they carved up Palestine, as Britain carved up the Indian subcontinent, as recently they carved up Bosnia. So it's, you know, it's the old Roman maxim, divide and conquer, and, you know, the British certainly believe in that.
They sure do, and Britain had a much stronger empire many, many years ago. But that pretty well, it didn't entirely disappear, but after World War II, most of the British Empire was lost. India, the crown jewel for Britain, became independent, and of course we've got Pakistan and Bangladesh, and but Britain still clings to the notion that they're an empire, Francis, and they
want
to hold...
Yeah, they even said that on the Falklands. Did you hear David Cameron? It was really funny to listen to. He was accusing Argentina of colonialism and pleading self-determination for the people on the Falklands, when the fact is, if you go back and read the historical record, and the definitive account was actually written by a professor at this law school named Goebel, you'll see Britain stole the Falklands from Argentina at a time when early time when Argentina simply was not in a position to protect or claim the Falklands. So, you know, the British government really has no shame, and they made the same argument on Northern Ireland, that they were there to protect the right of self-determination of the people of Northern Ireland. And eventually they gave that claim up in the series of documents, treaties they had with the Republic of Ireland. And now they openly and publicly admit that there is only one self-determination unit on the entire island of Ireland, and that is the unit that has the right of self-determination, and that the people living on Northern Ireland do not have a separate right of self-determination. But, you know, they're making this claim now on the Falklands, and I think hopefully most of us could agree it's completely preposterous.
Oh, it really is. And, of course, in the last couple of decades, Francis, they made the same argument the same way that America did, that they were going over to liberate the Iraqis and liberate the Afghans and liberate the Libyans. And the most liberation they did were the lives of millions of people for two decades, not the least of which were lost under the sanctions of the 1990s in Iraq that most people forget about. The toll was absolutely horrendous, and people keep dying every single day in all of these places. And, this is Britain's idea of liberation, Francis.
Yes, under Cromwell, when Cromwell invaded, he reduced the Irish. I think the figure was maybe 200,000 of us were left. It was outright extermination. And we barely survived. So you are correct. And indeed, there was a scholarly article done, which I read on the laws of war, where a professor analyzed the British extermination tactics in Ireland, and then pointed out that when the British came to North America, they then proceeded to apply the same extermination tactics on American Indians that they had applied to the Irish.
Oh, I didn't know that. I didn't know that. Well, I do know.
The scholarly article I read, it, you know, with footnotes, and it is in a scholarly book. So this isn't just, you know, anti-British propaganda or anything like that. He went through the whole thing, and there it was.
Oh, well, I know the work that Ward Churchill has done on Native peoples of the Americans, of the Americas. I mean, this stuff went on for 500 years or so where the Native people were exterminated. Whoever the controlling powers were, Britain or France or Spain or whoever was over here, I mean, they were just exterminating the Natives. And, of course, America did the same thing. And you talk about a Holocaust. I mean that really is the all-time Holocaust. Plus what was done to black people for a few centuries, maybe longer than that. But I think your book is very important, Francis, especially because not too many people think about Ireland and the fact, number one, that it's divided and why should it be, and what are the rights of the people who live there. I don't think people think at all about that. A lot of people think about Palestine, but Ireland is out of the spotlight. Certainly people aren't shooting each other on the streets, so it's a topic off the radar, and you're bringing it on the radar with your book.
Well, let me say, with all due respect, maybe that's sort of the mainstream news media, but the latest census showed there are 35 million Irish Americans, and I can assure you that these issues, United Ireland and, of course, the so-called famine, are the two leading issues today among Irish Americans. That's the other issue I address in my book on the potato famine was really a British genocide against the Irish. And, you know, I've introduced this book up at the Irish American Heritage Center in Chicago, and I stood there literally from 11 a.m. until 8 p.m. speaking with one person after another after another. Of course, they were all Irish, coming through either about United Ireland or about the famine as genocide. And so, yeah, if you look at the mainstream news media, which is very pro-British, as we know it is pro-Israel, you're not going to see much reported about it. But if you go to the Internet and get on the list, you'll see this is grassroots movements by Irish all over the country to support a united Ireland and to hold Britain accountable for the famine genocide against the Irish, where they starved a million Irish to death and forced 2 million to emigrate under forced deportation, 2 million under deplorable conditions, every bit as bad as the slave trade that you also referred to.
Francis, my apologies. I simply was not addressing the fact that there is a very large Irish population in America, and this very definitely is an issue for them. And I grew up in one heavily populated Irish city, Boston, and I live in another,
yeah,
Chicago.
Right. Talk about Irish.
Well,
that is Boston's. I lived there for 7 years, as you know, and boy, are they Irish in Boston,
oh,
as they are in Chicago.
Oh, in both cities, they are certainly so Irish. And, I mean, the Irish really run both cities. I mean, we've had Irish mayors in Chicago. I don't know what's been going on in recent years in Boston, but I grew up under Mayor Curley, and he certainly was an old-time Irish mayor. And this was the city of Boston. But, of course, in big cities, you get a lot of ethnicities. And Chicago, one of the many nicknames of Chicago is a city of neighborhoods, but certainly the Irish people of Chicago certainly have a very, very dominant place in the city.
Yeah, I grew up in Chicago. I lived there the first 21 years of my life, and I traveled all over Chicago. And, you know, it's a multiplicity, at least at that time, of ethnic communities. But it is fair to say that, I guess starting with the Daily Machine or even Connelly before that, the Irish did get organized, and certainly under Daly, to a lesser extent under his son, have exercised an enormous amount of political power in Chicago. And certainly when I was there in Boston, they did as well, because, you know, the Irish, like the Jews, realized that they had to get organized here in America, and they had to play politics like everyone else if they were going to protect themselves and their own interests from being exploited by the people running the country.
Indeed, so Francis, I'm afraid
that's the way politics get played in America, as you know.
Oh, indeed, I'm afraid we're out of time. I look forward to getting you back for more, and we can return to this issue again, and we can also cover others. And you certainly write on many, many issues, Francis. My great thanks to you for coming on. It's a treat for me when I can get you away from all your other activities and priorities.
Thank you very much, Stephen. One other point on the famine is genocide. I do argue why Irish should not be appropriating to themselves the word Holocaust or Shoah. I believe we should leave that to the Jewish people. And I said, let's use the word genocide. And I developed another term, hecatomb. If you read the record, they did at the time use both hecatomb and Holocaust. And my feeling is, you know, let the Jewish people keep Holocaust and Shoah. We Irish can use another term.
Oh, I agree. I agree. I prefer the word genocide. Again, my great thanks, Francis. And I'll just say to my listeners, join us on the weekend, 1 p.m. Eastern. Make it a regular habit.